This is William Fink. This is the Christogenia Open Forum. It is Monday, November 8th, 2010. The year's almost gone. I'm going to talk for a while tonight about Revelation chapter 7 and the 144,000 that bring us so much vision and interpretation. And first, let me say that, you know, I've been accused recently of being a preterist, which is just crazy. It's really a preterist believes that all prophecy was fulfilled by 70 A.D. If you want a white separatist preterist, go read the works of V.S. Harrell, who has, he's a man of 1,000 errors, trying to squeeze all the prophecies for fulfillment before 70 A.D. People that usually accuse me of being a preterist, they are almost often found to be futurists, whether they know it or not. You take many of the prophecies and try to squeeze them into some last 7 years of tribulation. And the truth is, we've been in tribulation for about 2,500 years. If you really examine my writings, you'll find that I believe in the historical view of prophecy. Prophecy has unfolded over the last 2,000 to 2,500 years. 2,000 if we count from the revelation of John, and longer if we count from the Old Testament prophets. And that thinking is perfectly in line, though we may differ on some of the details, with Wesley Swift and Bertrand Comparé and Howard Rand and Clifton Emmaheiser and even Eli James. We all, though we have our differences, we all agree the prophecies of the Old Testament and the New have unfolded over the last 2,000 years. For that reason, any of the prophecies we all believe are in our past. But that does not make us preterists, because preterists believe that all those prophecies were fulfilled by 70 A.D., as V.S. Harrell. Clifton is about to put out a paper, as soon as I get off my lazy butt and proofread it, which will show that both preterism and futurism, and he's written on this topic before, but it's buried in his teaching letters. This is one small essay showing that preterism and futurism were both products of the Catholic Church. Both of those views of prophecies are Catholic, Roman Catholic. And they were concocted, I can't say they were developed, they were concocted in order to divert from the popes the very evident revelation that the Catholic Church was not the kingdom of God, but was actually the second piece of the revelation. And if we go back to the Reformers, and some of the artwork for this exists on Christogenia, perhaps in my essay on misconceptions concerning Paul and the Church, we'll see that in the time of the Reformers, and there were many Protestant handbills made up, and wood carvings and other drawings and pieces of art that depicted the popes as that beast. Hence, the concoction of futurism and preterism to keep people fooled and to try to remove the guilt or divert the accusations of guilt away from the popes. You know, the popes might fool most Catholics, but they're not going to fool Yahweh. They're not going to fool God. Okay, now that being said, I'm going to read Revelation chapter 7. And then I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs from a document found on Clifton's website. It's lesson 5 of a 14-part series, Book of Revelation, I, Bertrand Comparé. Clifton had transcribed that some years ago from tape while I was in prison, and when I proofread it, I added a collection of notes to it, which Clifton thought were worthy enough to include with it. So you'll find a lot of my notes and some of Clifton's notes in that Revelation series on Clifton's website. Okay, Revelation chapter 7. After this, I saw four messengers standing upon the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth. The wind would not blow upon the earth, nor upon the sea, nor upon any tree. And I saw another messenger ascending from the rising of the sun, or from the east, having the seal of Yahweh who lives. And he cried out with a great voice, the four messengers to whom it had been given to do wrong to the earth and the sea. So it's very clear here that the four messengers holding the four winds are going to do wrong to the earth and the sea. Verse 3. Saying, do not do wrong to the earth, nor to the sea, nor to the trees, until he should seal the servants of our God upon their foreheads. And I heard the number of those being sealed, 144,000, being sealed out of all the tribes of the sons of Israel. From the tribe of Judah, 12,000, being sealed. From the tribe of Reuben, 12,000. From the tribe of Gad, 12,000. From the tribe of Aser, 12,000. From the tribe of Naphtali, 12,000. From the tribe of Manasseh, 12,000. From the tribe of Simeon, 12,000. From the tribe of Levi, 12,000. From the tribe of Issachar, 12,000. From the tribe of Zebulun, 12,000. From the tribe of Joseph, 12,000. From the tribe of Benjamin, 12,000 being sealed. Verse 9. After these things I looked, and behold, a great crowd, which to number it, no one was able, from all nations and tribes and peoples and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, having been cloaked in white robes and palm branches in their hands. They cry out in a great voice, saying, salvation is with our God, sitting upon the throne and with the Lamb. And all the messengers stood around the throne, and those of the elders and the four living creatures also fell upon their faces before the throne, and they worshipped Yahweh, saying, truly the praise and the honor and the wisdom and the gratitude and the dignity and the power and the might are for our God for the eternal ages, truly. And one from among the elders responded, saying to me, these who are cloaked in white robes, who are they, and where have they come from? And I said to him, my Lord, you know. And he said to me, these are they coming out from the great tribulation, and they have washed their robes and have whitened them in the blood of the Lamb. I would interject that therefore they must be Israel. Verse 15. This reason, they are before the throne of Yahweh, and they serve him day and night in his temple, and he sitting upon the throne shall tabernacle with them. They shall hunger no longer, nor shall they thirst any longer, nor shall the sun fall upon them, nor any burning heat, because the Lamb who is in the midst of the throne shall shepherd them, and shall guide them to fountains of living waters, and Yahweh shall wipe away every tear from their eyes. It's evident, reading the first six chapters of the Revelation, that we have first a vision and messages to seven ecclesiae, or seven assemblies, seven churches they're commonly called, right? And then we have a vision of the four horsemen, commonly called the four horsemen of the apocalypse. The apocalypse does not mean the end time Armageddon. Apocalypse only means revelation. Apocalypsis is the Greek word that we translate into English, revelation. That's all it means. Okay. It's very clear to someone who is well versed in history that the four horsemen of the apocalypse, they represent the rise and fall of the Roman Empire. It's also very clear to one versed in history, the events of Revelation 9 can only be referring to the Muslim and, well, the Arabic and Turkic conquests of a great deal of the Adamic world. Comparé would certainly agree with this and writes at great length about it. Here I'm going to read from the book of Revelation, Lesson 5 by Bertrand Comparé. Well, we're still going in the book of Revelation. And as you have seen, it is slow going because there is an awful lot in it. There are 2,000 years of history in it. In fact, 3,000, as far as that goes, because it does cover the millennium. And here is where Both Clifton, as he notes here, and I depart from compare, and he's talking about Revelation chapter 20 and the millennium. And I won't get into that tonight. Continue with compare. We had gotten into the matter of opening the seven seals. You remember, only one found worthy to open the seals was the lamb slain in the sacrifice, which was obviously symbolic of Yahshua the Christ himself. And as he opened each of these seals, didn't see what was read from the scroll, what was written on it. But an event took place which was symbolic of a great event or series of events in history. And we saw that these seals portrayed the final collapse of the Roman Empire. Fourth and last of the Babylonian succession of empires. It finally gotten down through the sixth seal, ends in Revelation chapter 6. Before we come to the seventh seal, there is a little parenthesis thrown in there. Seventh seal starts in Revelation chapter 8. Because it doesn't portray any stage in the collapse of the Roman Empire like the first six seals had. In Revelation 7, verses 1 to 3, which I just read, we are told that four angels, having power to hurt the earth, were holding back the four winds of heaven so that they couldn't blow. They were told not to hurt the earth, the sea, nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our Elohim, or God, in their foreheads. Now, if anybody thinks that Christianity is a new religion that has discarded Israel, you should get your eyes opened immediately on this. This particular group, who are the servants of our Elohim, are Israel, as the book expressly says. The Bible has identified Israel and only Israel as Yahweh's servants. Isaiah verses 8 to 10 of chapter 41, quote, "But thou, Israel, art my servant, Jacob whom I have chosen, the seed of Abraham, my friend, thou whom I have taken from the ends of the earth, and called thee from the chief men thereof, and said unto thee, thou art my servant, I have chosen thee, and not cast thee away. Fear thou not, for I am with thee. Be not dismayed, for I am thy Elohim. I will strengthen thee. Yeah, I will help thee. Yeah, I will uphold thee with the right hand of my righteousness." Compare then goes on. And Isaiah 44, verses 21 and 22. "Remember these, O Jacob and Israel, for thou art my servant, I have formed thee. Thou art my servant, O Israel, thou shalt not be forgotten of me. I have blotted out as a thick cloud thy transgressions, and as a cloud thy sins. Return unto me, for I have redeemed thee." Now, both of these passages were written after the 10-tribe northern nation of Israel had disappeared into the Assyrian captivity. Nobody can say Yahweh cast off 10-tribe Israel, because here he makes it very clear he has redeemed them, he has blotted out their sins, he is with them, including many of Judah and Benjamin deported by Assyria. Clifton references some notes there that I don't remember and I won't get into. Continue with compare. The book of Revelation, the servants of our God who are sealed are entirely of Israel. And Revelation 7, verse 4 says so, quote, "And I heard the number of them which were sealed, and there were sealed 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel." Nothing about the Congolese cannibals, nothing about the Chinese, just the children of Israel. Now verses 5 through 9 go on to enumerate the tribes, 12,000, out of each tribe who were sealed. Here is something which some people have had considerable difficulty in understanding. The number and names of the tribes don't come out the way you would expect. But we will see when we look into it that, after all, there is no real inconsistency there. All the tribes are named except the tribes of Dan and of Ephraim. Those are not mentioned. Now, actually, of course, there were 13 tribes of Israel, including the tribe of Levi, the priestly tribe. Levi, having had no territory of its own, were scattered through all the other 12. Looking upon them as independent states, you might say, each with its own territory, there would be only 12 and Levi not included. But here, they're not talking about land, areas, and government, but that out of each tribe were sealed a particular group of 12,000 of each tribe. It doesn't list Dan or Ephraim, but it lists the tribe of Joseph. Well, now, originally, of course, Joseph was one of the tribes, but then on his deathbed, old Israel himself split Joseph into the two tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. The reason why Dan is not mentioned is clearly not that Yahweh had anything against Dan more than any of the other tribes. But all this phase of Revelation is dealing with the troubles and devastation that came upon the old Roman Empire. We have to take this chapter in the context in which it sits, between the fall of Rome and the trials which were to follow, which began in Revelation chapter 8. Looking upon him, I lost my place, I think. The reason why Dan is not mentioned is clearly not that Yahweh had anything against Dan more than any of the other tribes, but all this phase of Revelation is dealing with the troubles and devastation that came upon the old Roman Empire, and by this time Dan was gone, completely outside of it. Dan was in no more danger from these plagues than the people on the American continent were, for Dan was already up on the shores of the Baltic Sea in the territory that Rome had never controlled. Now, as to Ephraim, the tribe of Manasseh is mentioned by name here as one of those from whom the 12,000 were sealed. Well, if you talk about the tribe of Joseph, who was left out of the tribe of Joseph except the tribe of Ephraim? Actually, as it stands, Ephraim is really included in this. And, as I say, meaning compare, was clear out of the picture as far as danger was concerned. Clifton has a note, see note number 3 at the end of the lesson. And that's a note that I wrote that explains the tribe of Dan was never mentioned in the Assyrian deportations. Dan had apparently already left Palestine. They were never in the Assyrian deportations, and therefore there was no need to seal them to see that they survived through these trials. Ectocompare. I want to call your attention one thing here. This chapter of Revelation speaks of two completely different and separate groups. First is the 144,000 out of the 12 tribes of Israel who are sealed. Well, now, you put your seal upon something as a mark of ownership. These were servants of Yahweh. Then it goes on, Revelation 7, verse 9, and after this I beheld, and lo, a great multitude which no man could number, out of all nations and kindreds and people and tongues, stood before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes and palms in their hands. You remember the four winds of heaven that were to bring disasters were held back until the servants of Yahweh were sealed, so they would be protected. In other words, they did not go through the plagues. But of these people in this great multitude, out of all nations and kindreds and people and tongues, the remainder of chapter 7 speaks of these and says, these are they which came out of the great tribulation and have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore they are before the throne of Yahweh and serve him day and night in his temple. And he that sits on the throne shall dwell among them. That's particularly verses 14 and 15. Now these have not been sealed to be protected from any plagues. These are people of this area of the Roman Empire who are going through these terrible judgments. And it will include those within the worldwide judgment that we are all about to enter. Not kept out of it, not saved from it, but they have gone through it without weakening in their faith. Now, I would say that instead of including those, the judgment which we are all about to enter, it includes those of the judgment which we have all already been through. And I don't know how even Compare could exclude the people who suffered trials in the 30 Years' War, in the Crusades, in World War I, in World War II. I don't know how he could skip over those. Therefore, they are before the throne of Yahweh and serve him day and night in his temple. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm going backwards again. Not kept out of it, not saved from it, but they have gone through it without weakening in their faith. They have remained loyal. Thus, you can see how these are treated differently. In other words, people not of the Israel group have no salvation open to them. All that Christianity promises in that way is open to them, but it still does not make them members of Israel with the particular job and the pay for it that is given to Israel. There's a note there that, and Clifton has a note here, but there's a note there that the people that wash their robes in the blood of the Lamb, they can only be Israel. Clifton says, at this point I am going to interrupt this message by Bertrand Compare for a moment. Compare has just unwittingly contradicted himself where he said nothing about the Congolese cannibals, nothing about the Chinese, just the children of Israel. Now I have to agree with him on about everything he has to say in these series of messages, but I take exception to the object and object to the remark that he just said concerning Revelation 7:9 as being about non-Israel peoples. Clifton is absolutely right. It's not. It's only about Israel. Yes, it would appear that the terms all nations and kindreds and people and tongues, would seem to include all the people upon the earth. Again, it is a matter of translation that is the problem. Now, these all nations and kindreds and people and tongues are the many nations of Israel and Israel only. I would say it's a matter of context that's the problem. Other than this, the only nations which could be included in the resurrection would be the Genesis 10 nations descended only from the white sons of Noah, Ham, Shem, and Japheth. That is not the context here. Revelation 7:9 just simply means dispersed Israel nations or Israel people with different customs and manners and languages. And I would agree with Clifton, who goes on to quote the Bible Knowledge Commentary by J.F. Walvoord. This is the same group mentioned in 6:9, but here they are wearing white robes and holding palm branches, apparently signifying righteous triumph. As Compre implied in his lesson number 3, the souls under the altar were Israelites. That's the end of Clifton's comment on that. Back to Compre. So that takes up the little parenthetical 7th chapter of Revelation. When we have gone into 8, we get back into the historical preview here. Revelation 8:1-4 state, and when he had opened the 7th seal, there was silence in heaven about the space of half an hour, and I saw the 7 angels stood before Yahweh, and to them were given 7 trumpets, and another angel came and stood at the altar, having a golden censer. And there was given unto him much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne, and the smoke of the incense, which came with the prayers of the saints, ascended up before Yahweh out of the angel's hand. And that's all I'm going to say. From Compre, it is very clear that Compre, and I must agree, believe that the sealing of the 12,000 from each tribe in connection with the fall of Rome assures us that 12,000 of each of those tribes taken into the Assyrian captivity would be protected from those plagues and that suffering. The rest of Israel are those who wash their robes in the blood of the Lamb. Only Israel could do that. They are the Israelites who are going to suffer the plagues, who are going to suffer and shed their blood on behalf of Christ or on behalf of the battle between the children of God and the children of the wicked. But they, too, are guaranteed eternal salvation. Next place in the next, Revelation chapter 8 gets into the 7 trumpets, and Revelation chapter 9 is a clear prophecy of the Turkic and Arabic invasions of Europe. And I'm going to make that perfectly clear later on, but hopefully by January or before January, when Eli and I start our series of programs on the Revelation, which we're planning to do on the Yahweh's Covenant People program. Revelation chapter 10 is a sure vision of the Reformation, the opening of the little book, the placing of scriptures in the hands of men. Next place that we see the 144,000 mentioned is in Revelation chapter 14. And after Revelation chapter 10, we have a departure from the historical record. And Revelation chapter 11 discusses the two witnesses. Revelation chapter 12, I should say after Revelation chapter 11, we really have a departure from the near historical record that's given in a vision in Revelation. Revelation chapter 12 discusses the, and 13 discusses the beasts, and that's really a separate topic, which encompasses entire opening chapters or opening half of the book of Revelation. Revelation chapter 14 talks about two great harvests. And there's a serious mistranslation in the King James Version, because the first harvest is the harvest of the parched, not the harvest of the ripe. And there's a word there that's mistranslated. You should read the Christogenia version of Revelation chapter 14. It's much clearer. There's a harvest of the parched, then there's a harvest of the ripe, and that goes right hand in hand. Once we see it that way and see that mistranslation, we see that that goes right hand in hand with Christ's discussion of the harvest of the tares and then the harvest of the wheat. Ending of Revelation 14 is this. And I looked and lo, and I'm reading from the King James, and I looked and lo, a lamb stood upon Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his father's name written in their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven, as the voice of many waters, and as the voice of a great thunder. And I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps. And they sung, as it were, a new song before the throne and before the beast and the elders. And no man could learn that song except the 144,000, which were redeemed from the earth. Now, this is a clear reference, I believe, to the 144,000 of Revelation chapter 7. We see that from the time of their sealing, and probably from the time of their departure from the earth, they have been with the Lamb and follow him wherever he goes. Let me read the next verse. For these are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb, Christ, whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb. The 144,000 in Revelation chapter 7 certainly seem to be the first fruits. However, here in Revelation chapter 14, we see that they were virgins. First, if you claim to be one of these 144,000, I would think that you should be with Christ now, because you were saved from the tribulations that underwent the tribes of Israel during the Roman Empire, its fall, and the Arab conquests. Second, if you want to claim to be one of these 144,000, and this is a direct comment to somebody who I don't think is here now, but who had these words with me over the weekend in one of Eli's forums. If you want to be one of these 144,000, I would think that you'd better be a virgin. And that person is married, so he better send his wife to Joe, Pennsylvania, because Joe needs her more than he does. And I'm being tongue-in-cheek there. However, if you want to claim a portion of this prophecy unto yourself, better claim it all. Don't be splitting hairs and making private interpretations of the prophecy. That person had told me that he understood the Song of Moses. If he understands the Song of Moses, he better be a virgin. Hello, Clifton.
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay. I just want to know if you had anything to interject.
No, I'm just listening. Pretty much in agreement with everything you...
Cutting out, Clifton. I'm sorry.
Can you hear me?
Yes, you just cut out for the end of what you said.
Anyway, I've been listening and... pretty much in agreement with everything you have presented so far.
Oh, well, that's all I'm going to present on the topic. I just wanted to demonstrate the historical interpretation of the 144,000 from the Revelation and from the works of Comparé. That I'm not making this stuff up myself.
Anybody that doesn't study the history along with Revelation, very, very foolish.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt.
What you need is a Bible in one hand and a history book in the other.
Absolutely. I totally agree, and this is perfectly clear. And I don't think that anybody walking on the earth now can claim to have been one of those people delivered out of the tribulations of the fall of Rome.
Well, as Copperay's, typing all that out, it took me a long time to type that on an old clunker typewriter. And I wasn't the fastest typer and everything like that. Just typing that out and doing it fairly slowly, I got real interested in history. I just hated history when I was in school. So history was kind of a new subject for me to get interested in. So I'd recommend that others, they're going to study Revelation. You better get it. You better go to a used bookstore and get some old history books and connect up some of those. Follow Comparé, too. He makes mistakes here and there. He does pretty good. And match the history book to the book of Revelation.
Well, right. The Revelation is the story of world history told in advance. I have no doubt. And now, 2,000 years later, we could see that a great deal of it has been fulfilled.
There isn't much to be fulfilled. And that doesn't make you a preterist either.
Oh, absolutely not. A preterist is somebody that believes that all this was fulfilled before 70 AD. And preterists have not a leg to stand on when you start asking them when and how it was fulfilled.
Well, you know, these people go around, and what they're doing, they're parroting Vera and Alcazar and Lacunza and a bunch of other Jesuit priests, and they don't know it.
Absolutely. The preterists and the futurists are parroting Jesuit priests. Here asks, essentially, the revelation is the history of the world from the time of Christ until the end of the age, whenever that is. Veer, that's nearly correct, because there are bits and pieces of the revelation that discuss things from before the time of Christ. Not much. But there are some. And of course, Revelation chapter 12 is an example of that. Revelation chapter 12 is a clean break from Revelation chapter 11. The two witnesses end a historical vision of a contiguous history, I should say, from the time of the four horsemen of the apocalypse to the end of the two witnesses. That's one vision. It's an overview of history. It's very clear that it's contiguous once you know the history and study the text. I lost what I was going to say. I'm sorry. The Revelation 12 goes back to the beginning again and discusses the battle between the dragon and God and Michael and his angels, right? And then goes on to the two beasts. Two beasts are actually, the first beast is the series of empires, and the second beast is the papacy.
Well, not only that, but it fits in with Daniel.
Oh, yeah, Revelation chapter 13 fits in with Daniel chapters 2 and 7 perfectly, where Daniel talks about the series of empires. And in chapter 7, he also talks about the papacy.
The Pope was one of the little horns, Daniel. There was two little horns. One of them was Muhammad. The other one was the Pope.
Right, and that's Daniel 7 and Daniel 8. Now the period of Revelation that we're in right now has to be, since 1913 at least, Revelation chapter 17, verse 17, and I'm going to read that in the King James because I could find it faster on my computer. For God has put in their hearts to fulfill His will and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God shall be fulfilled. The words of God are the words of the I believe he's talking about the reference to the last battles in the Day of Judgment. And that's spelled out in Ezekiel 38 and 39, and actually in Revelations 18, 19, and 20. That's where we are right now. Our kingdom's handed over to the beast, and anybody that denies that has no concept of who has the kingdom and who is the beast. I mean...
And you can kind of tell where it started around the French Revolution, you know?
Yes, absolutely.
That's when they got the guillotine and off come the heads. Well, Revelation speaks about heads coming off.
Well, right. The revelation that the French Revolution was. I think that the process that enabled the French Revolution started with the De Medici popes. When they had actually legalized usury and did the Jews a lot of favors in Europe and the bankers, right? Well, the French Revolution actually was the signal that Satan was out of the pit, because that's when the Jews in Europe gained equal citizenship with the Christians. They didn't have that before the French Revolution.
Yeah, Catherine de Medici, I forget, Charles VI that she was married to, but the one that got all the pagans worked up, and during the middle of the night they went out and got the Protestants out of their beds and took them out and hung them on trees and stuff. Of course, the Catholic Church has celebrated that ever since as Saint Bartholomew's Day. And see, Comrade, you know, he's got a connection there because part of that group is what were they called now? They can't remember it. Caporet was able to trace his lineage back to.
Hey, you're talking about the Protestants in France, and I'm embarrassed too because I can't remember it either.
Well, if the people read those 14 lessons, they'll get it. It was a lot of typing and.
Seven of None has it. Kent has it. The Huguenots.
Huguenots. Yeah, Huguenots. Yeah, Caporet was a Huguenot.
Well, this is an open forum. If anybody wants to talk, please give me the signal so I can turn your microphone on. MacDog, you're in my crosshairs, MacDog. You should be number one here wanting to talk. Come on, MacDog, don't be shy. Well, the fall of Babylon is in the near future. Here? Hi, MacDog, let's hear it.
Hey, Bill, I just have to disagree a little bit on, on 14, because I think maybe that could mean the virgins in there could mean people who didn't go along with the Antichrist church.
Oh, well, you know something, MacDog, I'm not going to argue with that because you're right, right? It's everything in the Revelation is symbolic, okay? And it very well could be that the 144,000 who were virgins, even though it says they weren't defiled with women, right? And that's pretty literal. But everything in the Revelation is written in symbols. So it probably means something else. Like they weren't defiled with the whore religions and the pagan religions of the world. However, the person that I'm addressing, he insists on taking the Song of Moses literally and claims to know it. So if the Song of Moses is taken literally and he knows it, then he better be a virgin. Because you're not going to take one figuratively and the other literally. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I got you. I'll have to look up that song. I've never actually heard that.
Bruce, that was a little heavy breathing going on. Well, that's Revelation chapter 14, MacDog. And if you're going to take the Song of Moses literally, you're gonna have to take the virgin literally, right? You better be a virgin. I'm sorry. You can't take one figuratively and the other literally.
Yeah, maybe if we can get commanded to talk, maybe we'll have him sing it for us.
Well, he's already told me that he knows it and I can't know it. And I informed him that there's no private interpretation of prophecy.
Isn't the 32nd chapter of Deuteronomy, isn't that the Song of Moses?
Well, yes, that is the Song of Moses. That is entitled the Song of Moses. Is this the Song of Moses? Maybe this doesn't say the Song of Moses. Maybe I'm just confused. What does it say here? Oh, they would sing a new song, doesn't it? I'm sorry, I'm confused. And they sung as it were a new song before the throne. I'm confused, I apologize. Well, McBragg, or Son of the Mist here, right? He claimed to know that song. And my point is that if he takes that song as a literal song, then he had better be a literal virgin. You're not going to take one figuratively and the other literally. It just doesn't work. And he told me that I can't know the song. So he knows it, and it's secret. And I told him, there's no private interpretation of prophecy. I'm sorry. Well, I agree that this song that's being sung, only certain people are going to understand. Yes, I agree with that. But it's not a literal song.
You know, that's the way the one seedliners take Genesis 3:15. They take a literal view of the woman and
a metaphorical view of the seed, right.
Figurative of the, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right, which is also ridiculous. All things being equal, they have to both be descendants.
So that game of making something figurative or literal, you know, make the scripture read the way you want it, you get all kinds of results by playing that game.
Exactly. And that's my exact point in addressing McBragg, Commander McBragg. Is that he takes the if he takes the song that nobody but the 144,000 can sing. I don't know why I called it the Song of Moses. I think I just had two wires crossed in my feeble brain. If he takes that song that nobody else can sing literally, then he has to be a virgin. And he better send his wife packing because he's not fulfilling his husbandly obligation.
When my granddaughter was born, a grandson, I sent him a little card, blessings upon, you know, and my granddaughter was born, I sent another one, and I had been looking through an old magazine of early 1900s or 1800s late, and there was one phrase in there, and I used it, when she lifted up her voice in song. In other words, she wasn't singing, she was, you know, the infant crying, like for hunger or something like that. But first lifted up her song. lifted up her voice in song. So I think in this case, it's not so much like you're saying, it's not a singing of a musical score, but it's more of an attitude or an expression that they have.
Or an understanding that they have that the others don't. Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, MacDog. Does that answer your question, MacDog? Probably not.
Well, yeah, pretty much. I mean, I'm spending a lot of time in that right now because of the other night what we were talking about with Commander, and I've just been doing trying to dive into it and read everything and understand it,
Oh, right. It's clear that these 144,000 with Christ are appearing at the final, at the harvest, right? I mean, that's what the whole rest of the chapter talks about, is the harvest. But that first harvest is a harvest of the parched. King James translators took a word, and word is a verb from an adjective, zeros, which means dry and withered. And they took this word and they translated it ripe. Which is absolutely ridiculous. It was an absolutely ridiculous translation. I was shocked when I read it. And that's in Revelation 14, verse 15. That's the harvest of the parched. Next harvest is the harvest of the ripe, where the word actually means ripe. And that's in verse 18.
I think they referred to the wave sheaf offering in the Old Testament as the... because a lot of times they had the parched of barley. So there might be a connection there.
Okay. Well, my connection is based. I think I translate that word Zerus withered, and to me it's referring to the tares. And I could be wrong, but that's my interpretation.
Oh, I see.
Because we have a withered vine and we have a fully ripe vine, in contrast with each other. To me, that's the wheat and the tares.
Well, if you throw weeds into a fire, they wither.
Yeah. Well, we have to have something else here tonight. I'm about done with 144,000 virgins. I'm starting to sound like Islam.
They're not virgins anymore?
Maybe that's where they get the idea from. Looks like Ricardo's got a question.
There are places where it says that two-thirds of the men are going to die in Revelation chapter 9. I believe that two-thirds of the men of our race did die in the wars against our race. By the Muslims, by the Turks, and it's still going on. If you look at the map that the white world used to occupy and look at it today, in Europe and Asia, you'll find that we only have about a third of our territory left, if that.
Our borders are according to our numbers, and there's not very many of us left.
Okay, we better have some conversation if we're going to have an open forum. I did 90% of the talking for the first 50 minutes.
Clifton mentioned in one of his teaching letters how, and it makes a lot of sense that the symbol or the word is not the actual thing, and it's to see the tricks that play on attempting some personal ambitious. Grasping onto something that the words can't how can I say? It's more of an attitude or approach or a pointing to the entire scripture and history, and it's the darndest hardest thing for a white man or woman to get beyond this mythology of loving your race as being bad. I mean, it's that in itself is a perversion, isn't it?
Well, of course. Yeah, Clifton, it's very egotistical to claim to be a part of the 144,000 or to claim to be a part of the two witnesses. And we were talking, Clifton and I, the other day on the phone and about how many people have claimed to be one of the two witnesses. And it's quite a few. And how many people? And they all went down in flames, right? And none of them went to heaven, and in front of all their brethren, as it says in Revelation chapter 11. And a lot of men claim to be a part of the 144,000. In fact, so many claim to be a part of the 144,000 that it's probably up to about 144 million by now, and half of them are Negroes.
Yahweh, help us.
So it's just, it's that that's in American Christianity, and I believe that if you knew that you were part of that special group, you'd probably not want to mention it and put down your brethren with such egotistical statements. You would probably keep your mouth shut. You don't, you know, the real angels, you don't know they're angels, right?
A good number of those claiming that are Jehovah Witnesses.
Well, right. There's at least 144 million of them, and probably more than half of them are Negroes.
They were only going to have 144,000 converts when they started, you know. Jehovah Witness comes to my, generally two of them when they come to my door. I just tell them I'm 1,001. Way of telling them I don't want to be part of their crowd.
Exactly. Oh, sorry, you already have a full house. Count me out.
Jehovah Witnesses, they got a lot of blacks in that organization.
That's a huge vehicle for race mixing on the East Coast. I don't notice it up here because there are hardly any blacks, but it's very noticeable down in New Jersey.
Yeah, the last couple of JWs that approached me, the white fellow would sit in a car and send the Negro up to the truck with some literature, like a dog. Go get him, boy.
Well, no, Veer. I don't put Commander McBragg in the same category with the clowns. But I just think that he's seriously wrong on this, and it'd be great if he were here tonight, and he's not. But I planned on talking about this all week, and ever since he had taken exception to things that I said on a program the other night, and I felt that even though he's not here, I had to proceed with it. That's the way it is. He must have been clued in, and that's why he didn't show up. Nah, I'm not saying that, but I'm just making a jest. But, well, right, MacDog, he won't ever talk. But he'll give out his email address the other day on right on TalkShoe, and where the podcast is and the chat room banter are all recorded, and he typed his email right into the window and let it fly, but he won't talk on a microphone. I don't get that. I can't. Okay, this is an open forum, people. We need some conversation. There's like 25, 30 people here. Nobody wants to talk. We could talk about something else. We could change the subject. Dr. Volunteer Cheryl. Cheryl will have to talk on Thursday. She won't have a choice. Bruce, how have you been? You've been scarce.
Oh, good. I've been getting situated because I've been living in a truck down by the river for the last 3 years. Well, actually, out on the highway, you know. I rented a shop with two. It's a body shop, and an old man lived here and ran a body shop for 25 years, and he died. And I bought a old Toyota, 87 Toyota. An old man lived in it, and he died. And kind of sounds kind of gruesome, but death isn't so bad when you know how to live. And so I'm building this 87 Toyota into the Anglo-Saxon Christian Israel Identity galleon ship. And I have a big shop to work on it, and a real nice old fellow named Robert. He's Pentecostal, but he's racist, so maybe I can get... He's listening about the... Anglo-Saxon Christian Israel identity message. So,
well, I'll bring him here one night. I'll talk to him.
Yeah, yeah. He has a tractor.
He has a tractor. I guess that's a big thing down south. That's how we identify ourselves. How you doing? My name's Bill. I have a tractor.
Most of us spend most of our life trying to a tractor, right?
Thinks my tractor is sexy, right, Steven? You're not a real redneck unless you got a tractor. I'm just SOL. WCB, You wanted to talk. Here's your big chance. Come on.
I don't know what to talk about yet.
Well, you asked to talk and you don't know what to talk about yet. What kind of stuff is that?
Well, that was a preemptive measure just in case I wanted to talk.
Oh, okay. You did that last week, too. You know that. And you left without never having said a word.
I was probably doing homework.
I just thought I'd call you out on that.
All right, I'll figure something out.
All right.
Oh, yeah, Bill, did you hear about the South Carolina governor? I think her name's Nikki Haley or something. She's Indian.
Indian, like from India?
Yep. Well, she's married to one guy. But, yeah, that's why her last name's Haley.
She's from India, and she's the governor of South Carolina? Yeah, that's crazy.
Oh, wait, I'm pretty sure she's the governor. Wait. Indian American Nikki Haley, Republican Party. Yeah, she's the governor of South Carolina. Just elected.
Wow. Be burning incense to Shiva or
Krishna?
Krishna or one of those clowns in the South Carolina Capitol building, I guess. They can't fly a rebel flag, but they'll burn incense to Krishna.
No, she isn't mixed. Both her parents are Sikh, and they came from Amritsar, India. She was born here, though, I think.
But she wasn't born from above. That's the important thing.
Yeah, right.
She's Methodist, and I don't know how many kids she has. I think she has more than four, though.
Well, that's a shame. Okay, come on, guys. This is an open forum. We need something to talk about. Ian.
Oh, wow. There's a Mexican that's governor of Florida. That's tough. She's a Tea Party movement person.
Yeah, of course. She wants to sell more tea. She's Indian, isn't she? Oh, he has an uncle in the business.
I was at a truck stop this morning, about 4:30 in the morning at this truck stop. They call it Love's. What a ridiculous name for a truck stop, Love's. But some fellow was in there talking about the new...
You're a crack whore.
He's talking about the New World Order, you know, the New World Order. He kept saying New World Order, New World Order to these two cashiers. And I said, oh, I guess it's just a Jew incidence that the Jews are involved behind all these criminal networks, right? And I was just openly talking to him about the Jews. And I mean... If you talk about it to folks, you know, they're not everybody's going to cry anti-Semite, you know, little white folks. But I notice the non-whites, they will want to argue, you know. Maybe I'm pretty naive, but I don't even talk to them.
Well, you know, there's no sense in arguing with non-whites about religion and Bible. It's absolutely not. You're better off just sticking your head under your truck tire. I'll bet you can't do that and drive over it at the same time. I knew a lot of guys in my life that wanted to argue with the facts that they shouldn't be argue with the Jew, that Jesus wasn't a Jew. Better off jumping off a roof. You're never going to convince them. You're better off just leaving them alone.
Yep.
Like arguing with a tick, not to bore through your skin.
Yeah, and I can see Christ going to the Celtic Galileans and to the Greeks and to the barbarians and the Romans. And I can see that it's in Scripture that it's those Canaanite Edomites that were the ones that were chasing after him, you know, trying to trip him up all the time. And there's... Huge historical evidence in Scripture that he didn't go to the goats.
Well, no, he didn't go to the goats. They were always coming to him.
Yeah.
If you look at the Scripture, I mean, the Pharisees sent to question him. Sadducees sent to question him. He never went to them.
Mm-hmm.
He addressed them when they confronted him. Addressed the Sadducees when they confronted him, and likewise with the Pharisees. Some of the Pharisees followed him, but he wasn't. They weren't the object of his attention, or at least not the primary object of his. Even Nicodemus came to him at night.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Pharisee.
And if it's only the Father can draw us to Himself, that that it must be, it has to be in the blood, in the seed, in the genes.
Well, it surely is. Our genes are us, and there's no getting around it. And there's no escaping it.
But it seems like these Eastern so-called religions, it seems that the Eastern type of religions are more of a Canaanite breed of religion, isn't it?
But, well, I don't really know what you're trying to say. I mean, there's no doubt to me that Hinduism is an evil pagan worship. That Shintoism, the Chinese are the original dragon worshippers. But there's no doubt.
Well, what I'm getting to is they spiritualize everything. They spiritualize it away with all kinds of, battle, confusion, reincarnation, or working to be one of the 144,000 even. They spiritualize that and make it personal. Comes in a way not to be seen of men. You know that scripture in John? The kingdom comes in a way not to be seen. But they want to, what they do is they spiritualize it and mix it up in a big poo-poo soup. And it really is a big poo-poo soup where everybody... I know the dragon people even have a food dish they call the poo-poo dish. I don't know. I don't have a fetish with that stuff, but what I'm saying is they make trivial the most beautiful thing in this world, and that's the white race. Now, everything to trip us up.
You'd be surprised at the number of there in Israel identity incarnation. Just a lot of people in Israel identity with nation.
Right. Somebody asked what dragon worship is, and let me tell you that in Chinese legend and mythology, and not only Chinese but all the other Asian legends, the dragon is a symbol of power and good luck and good fortune and strength, and they worship the dragon. They make statues out of dragons. They put on dragon suits and march around on New Year's Day. That they portray dragons in their art. That they venerate dragons, dragon worshippers. And I think they probably got that from their first father. I think they probably have the same origin that the Jews have. To be wrong, seems to me to explain a whole lot. Did I interrupt something?
No.
Can't possibly do that here.
Did Clifton say that there's a lot of folks in who claim to be Christian identity that are Israel identity that are believing in reincarnation?
Well, there's a lot of people in Israel identity that believe in reincarnation, or that believe in a whole lot of false doctrines that really came from these outside religions, from Buddhism or from Hinduism or from some other form of paganism.
Oh, yeah.
There is no reincarnation in Scripture. There's a couple of passages that could be construed to indicate reincarnation, but there's no reincarnation in Scripture.
Yeah, where it speaks of the spirit of Elijah as John the Baptist, but that he's speaking about the spirit of preaching, the message.
I'll prove real quick that John the Baptist wasn't Elijah himself. I could prove that in one question. How come when Peter at the Transfiguration on the Mount, when the apostles saw Elijah, they didn't say, "Look, there's John the Baptist." I guess John the Baptist wasn't Elijah.
They've been watching too much Star Wars, maybe.
Well, that alone proves that John the Baptist wasn't Elijah. Transfiguration on the Mount. All the reincarnation believers can just go beat her.
Oh, yeah. Well, this message of Israelite Christian identity is that we were crucified with Christ. When it says that, he's speaking, the apostle's speaking of his kinsmen alone, right? Yeah, that would make perfect sense. As a collective whole of his race.
Well, of course, Bruce. I mean, that's the whole context of the New Testament. But reincarnation might be true for the other races, and Hinduism might have a glimpse of truth in it for the other races. Demons were inside a man, and then they wanted to go inside of a pig, right? That's right in the scripture. But that's not the truth for us.
Yeah, and they wander about looking for, and they say, well, go back to the place where we were. And it's the... It sounds like that dead spirit just goes on, a dirty river or something.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the Book of Enoch says that demons come from bastards. Evil spirits come from bastards. And there's no doubt that they transmigrate from creature to creature. That's right in Scripture. And that's a Hindu belief, which, you know what? That proves to me that the Hindus are demons.
Oh, yeah.
That's living proof that the Hindus are demons. So if they want to believe that stuff, it's good for them. But it's not good for the white man whose religion is Christianity and whose God is Yahweh. And by that, we know that those Hindus are demons. That we shouldn't try to be converting them to Christianity. Pretty simple. That there's no disparity.
Mm-hmm. Sorrow not as those who have no hope, and darn expected to have hope.
Well, right. They only have hope that they might occupy a pig after they occupy their own bodies. But the bodies are in now.
Mm-hmm.
That's their only hope. And maybe the pigs won't rush over the embankment and drown.
Years ago, I was reading someone's interpretation of that, where the man with the mental problems called Legion comes up to Joshua, and they had a conversation. But afterwards, Joshua casts out these demons, and the demons went into the swine that were there, and the swine ran into the lake and drowned themselves, and then all the people there. And you have to read it right. I have to read it right. Is the people said, why don't you just get out of here?
Right. They didn't want anything to do with Christ.
No, because they didn't want them to come around, because they were ruining their business. Well, their business was raising swine. And the implication is that they probably were Israelites, but they were not really practicing the faith. They were just raising swine, even for someone else, you know, that still would be a sin. And that he tossed it into this swine, and they ran off in there and drowned themselves as a kind of like a double lesson here, you know, that those that were practicing that, raising swine, and are Israelites, they were not supposed to do that. And that's just one man's. I don't remember who it is now, but that was the reasoning that he put behind it, is that it was forbidden food. And these are people that are not supposed to eat or even be around the forbidden food of swine. So it's a two-for-one special there.
Hello?
Hello? Gerald, are you there?
Hello?
Hello, Gerald, are you there?
Yeah, I was trying to get my mic. Yeah, can you hear me?
Well, yeah, I can, but it cuts in and out.
I can hear you fine.
Yeah, for some reason, it's not wanting to work. I was going to mention something back when y'all were discussing the dragons, and I learned a little bit about that when I got into the antique business, and I had an antique shop. And, of course, back in the 70s, Chinese antiques were very, very popular, and you could actually acquire Dynasty at a fairly reasonable price. And I noticed that the dragons were a prominent feature throughout all of the hand-painted plates and bowls and dishes and statues. And the dragons were closely associated with royalty in China, even to the point that special dishes were used for the emperor and various members of the royalty. And if anyone else was caught eating out of a plate that was reserved for that emperor or something, they were immediately put to death. And one of the things that we had, the little rice, they were rectangular bowls. They were in white copper, and they had porcelain painted on the inside, and they were dragons. And it depended upon how many toes the dragon had as to what rank of royalty could eat out of them. And it just, you know, it was just amazing the role of the dragon throughout the Chinese culture. And y'all were mentioning that earlier, and I was thinking about that. But Bill was right. It's amazing, you know, how much the serpent plays in that particular race, and of course it goes back thousands of years.
Oh, I think that's their origin. That's why they worship them.
Didn't Cain get a wife from the
I don't think there's any exact telling, but it's reported those races were in Asia at that time, and there were no white people in Asia at that time that Cain could have got a wife from.
Cain couldn't even go. He was cursed, so he couldn't even take somebody of his own family. He had to marry.
Wouldn't he have married into his, essentially, into his father's side of the family? Assuming that Cain was not fathered by Adam?
I don't know if Satan had other children around. Do you have a family or some other families around Satan?
I'm sure they did. I mean, there were a lot of fallen angels. They already went out and mixed their seed with every species. I'm sure there were lots of Satan's children around. Cain was just the first one of Satan's children with an Adamic woman. But that's the way I see it.
Yeah, and I kind of look at it like this, as far as the Genesis, is that that's as far back as they could remember as far as people. And that was a significant event anyway, and they just continued a family history from there. But it seems they had to have other people there, because where would you get this wife from? Unless, because it doesn't say that it was specifically created, like they suggested Eve was created out of the, you know, rib and stuff like that, or something along those lines. There have to be other people there, and other, obviously other parents and other mothers of this wife of Cain, was it, whatever her name was.
Well, see, Adam was naming all the animals, and while he was he evidently was naming some of these half fallen angel, half ape, you know, that type of animal, because what, I mean, he wouldn't want to get a wife of a lion or a tiger or an elephant or something like that. But, you know, you might suggest, very, very unkosher, you might suggest that other people have two hands and have a structure or something like we have. I got a hunch that that's evidence there that they're, that the fallen angels mixed with animals long before Adam was ever created. So the blacks and Mongolians here long before the Adam.
Well, we can't see it in scripture, but that's the way I would see it in because of what we know from anthropology and archaeology.
Why would it even suggest that he was looking for a wife among the animals, though?
It's only to, it's a parable in order to demonstrate to us that we shouldn't look for wives among the animals.
Well, I think so, and we shouldn't look for wives among these pre-Adamites.
Well, exactly. The only wife we could have is one who is flesh of our flesh and bone of our bone, another woman that looks like you.
I pity the woman that looks like me.
Well, Gerald, I'm sure that long ago and once upon a time, it probably wasn't so bad.
That's funny, Gerald.
Have you got any pictures when you were around 20 years old?
Yes, Clifton. I've got albums of pictures going back to when I was a little baby. Matter of fact, I have them all through during the Shriners Hospital with my braces. And, I for some reason, I saved all those pictures, and I get them down and look at them. And actually, I was a cute baby, but then when I got into grade school, I got kind of ugly. And then when I got into high school with the black leather jackets and turtleneck sweaters, and, you know, we used to wear our shirts with the collars turned up and unbuttoned down to our navel, and that was cool. You know, of course, we had on an undershirt underneath it, but I've got pictures during that period, too. And I wasn't too bad looking, but when I went to the college my first year at Tech, my hair all started coming out. And I, at the end of my second year in college, I was bald as a bowling ball. And so I had to adjust there. But I guess as I've gotten older, you know, old sometimes lose their ugliness. And I don't think I'm quite as ugly as I used to be. I didn't mean to get on that. At once I wasn't too bad looking, I think. I actually had some girlfriends. I was engaged twice and almost married. There was this little Catholic girl in junior high school that I fell in love with, and she was Italian. Of course, I didn't know a lot back then, but her name was Loretta. And she was short and black-haired and had the prettiest green eyes you ever saw in your life. And I was absolutely enthralled with her. And she later became, as she got into a senior in high school, she was a what was called Mr. Lynn's cover girls in Shreveport, and she was a model. And her family wanted me to marry her, even though I wasn't a Catholic. They insisted that I sign a document declaring that our children, all of our children, would be raised Catholic, and I refused to sign. And so they forbade her to marry me at that point. And so I went my way, and she went hers. And 6 months later, she ran off with a Baptist son preacher. So I thought that was fitting. And then I had a little love affair when I was in college, and but I never married, and I have no family now. I have no children. I suppose if I had to list the one regret in my life, it would be that I never married. I never found my soulmate and married and had children, because honestly, I have no one to take care of me. I've had a bunch of regret in life, if we're allowed to have a regret, is that I didn't have the blessedness of having a family and being able to rear children and have little grandkids bouncing around on my knee. And I regret that very much today. But 70 years old, expect strongly that's going to happen.
Well, it happened to Abraham.
But, well, you know, once upon a time we had big families so that the old would take care of the young and the young would take care of the old, and in nurturing our children, what we were assured that they would take care of us when we needed them. Today, the Jew has our kids moving out of our houses at 18, and then they move to another state. We never see them again. What difference does it make? But there's no such thing as a family home anymore.
Yeah, now the modern so-called modern world, for the kids to take care of their parents, they really take care of them.
Well, up here there's an incredible amount of people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s that have their own homes that have nobody. They're all gone. They're all long gone, down to the city, or down south, or off to greener pastures somewhere, perceivably. So then when this generation of elderly people die, who's going to move in? Arabs and Negroes. That's who's going to move in. And where are the kids? They're in the city playing playing sex change. And they're not having children.
A lot of the children weren't even born anyway. A lot of the things like Bush was saying a couple of years ago when he was presidente, Now, he says, well, a lot of illegal aliens are doing the work that Americans don't want to do. Well, that's not true, because my generation, the baby boom generation, and my children's generation, which are like the late 30s, let's say, they didn't have enough children, so that the people that should be young enough to take those jobs were never born to begin with, so there's no white people there to occupy them today.
Well, to a great degree, that's true, because my mother and father, they may have had more kids, but they were both working. After the inflation of the 70s, of the late 60s and early 70s, they both had to work.
Yeah, yeah. Couldn't afford it.
And I had six kids. I tried to have more, but they locked me up.
You know, here in Louisiana, we began seeing the farms slowly disappear. Because the young people were leaving farms, they didn't like the farm life. It was too hard, too demanding, and so a lot of them, when they went off to college, of course, they didn't come back to the home place. And it is so sad. All of these old home places grown up, and the houses falling in, and there's no one there to tend them. And it's just part. And of course that means that there's not produce being raised and cows and farm animals for food and all are not being raised, and we're going to the supermarkets buying meat now instead of raising our own. The only thing that we do have going on down here, and that is the venison. All the great white hunters are out shooting Bambi's parents and sometimes Bambi if they don't get caught, and that's good clean food. And of course, unfortunately, hogs are very prominent down here. Pork is a major a staple here in the South. It always has been, even during the Civil War. I guess had it not been pork and bacon, all a lot of the Southerners during Reconstruction would have starved to death. But and the Yankees sure liked it because they stole all of it everywhere they went. They stole all of the bacon and pork and everything they could get their hands on. But it just breaks my heart to see all of these home places virtually in ruins now. And think back of the big, fine white families lived there and took care of those homes. And it's part of our culture and our heritage that I keep harping about all the time. That we're losing, or we've lost. And unfortunately, the younger people, the generations 30 years and even 40 years old, they don't have any concept of what I talk about when I speak how the late 40s and the 50s and even into the 60s were kind of like a golden era. And those days are gone. I know I mentioned a little bit earlier in the chat room in Sherrod, but I asked if anyone had seen the movie The Last Picture Show. And the reason why I liked that movie so much was because it was depicting the 1950s lifestyle of the 50s, and I think it did a rather good job. I know I reminisce every time I see the movie. But it's a golden era that's gone. And when I think about the old plantation homes down here, and of course a lot of those big old houses are gone now. They've been torn down for the material in them. But when I was young, I can remember plantation after plantation that had been abandoned because the family had died out and the children left home. And there was nobody left to tend and mend the acreage. Consequently, they was cut up and sold for small plots and things. But it's a bygone era, and I think some of you older folks in the chat room know what I'm talking about. I'm not trying to pinpoint Clifton as being old, but I know that Clifton probably understands what I'm talking about very much because he and I are, he may be a little older than I am, but. Clifton, you know what I'm talking about, don't you?
Well, I'm 83 and a half years old.
Who's counting?
Hey, young man.
Clifton, I just told Clifton that that when I get to be, if Yahweh allows me to live to 83, I hope that he allows me to have the mind that you do and the ability and desire and energy that you have. I admire you greatly for what you've done for us and what you're doing now. And I just wish we had lots more Cliftons out there doing what you're doing. And I know Bill will and Eli and some of the younger folks coming along, Lord willing, they'll do a lot of great works even beyond what they've done now. But I'm always amazed and the tremendous contribution that you have done to Christian identity. And, you know, I just wish that I could be of your stamina when I get to be your age.
Well, I'm nobody special, but I have tried to make the Israel identity effectable message.
Well, that's what we need more than anything is good scholarship and to decide some of the clowns, right? And that half year is important when you're 8 and when you're over 80. I'm sorry, Clifton. I had to get that in there.
Well, once the mind starts becomes throbbing with the being identified by the Almighty as a true heir, like Daryl was saying, the society is just absolutely enthralled and just secondhand cheap social miscreants that love pleasure and associate pleasure with love. And there's no association at all.
Bruce, let's get rid of that beeping and talking in your background. That's easy to get rid of. If you just click settings and options.
You got a lot of bells there, Bruce.
Settings and options. And then choose notifications from the list on the left.
Okay, I'll try.
You know, I'd like to say something since, you know, I brought up the question of age. I'd like to say something just a moment on the other end of the spectrum. You know, it's so good to see young people participating in our, like WCB and MacDog and even Icelander over there in Iceland. And I know there's some, I'm not sure about all of the ages of everybody in the group. But to see these young people with the knowledge that they have now and the interest and all, I'm hoping that Yahweh has a special place to take over as some of the older people begin to die out. And, you know, that's been one of our downfalls, but we haven't had people to pick up and carry the ball when other people die out. And, of course, that's been true in our, I hate to use the word conservative, but in our conservative world that we had in the 50s and 60s, when a lot of those great giants passed on, Gerald L. K. Smith, I won't start naming them, but you know who all I'm talking about. When they began to die out, we did not have the young people there that were trained and interested to pick the ball up and run with it. And consequently, the liberal establishment took over and captured the minds of the young people in the colleges and everywhere else. So when you run across people like MacDog and WCB and some of these other ones that have a certain amount of knowledge and are learning, it gives me a good sense of feeling to think that there's still hope for us and we're going to continue this thing because we don't know how long it's going to last. You know, we all pray that Yahshua has come quickly, but it may be a good while yet before he comes. And so we don't know how long this thing's going to drag on. But I encourage all the younger people to study and to learn and participate in all of the CI programs. And, you know, I wish that I didn't live so cotton-picking far away from everybody down here in the Piney Woods, Louisiana, because nothing would give me greater satisfaction than to be able to share this library that I have built over my entire lifetime that's just sitting here now, virtually not being used, and to have people to come in and study and learn. When Brian came down and spent those 2 weeks, he just had the best time in the world going through that library. And he only did just a very small portion, but it tickled me to see him get so in interested in it. And I just wish that some of you folks could come. And I know I've said this many times, and I know y'all get tired of hearing it, but I live here alone, and I love company. And any of my CI family friends are more than welcome to come here. And it would do my heart good to have some of you come visit.
One thing we could do, the older people, if you want to call us that, and if we have the financial wherewithal to do it, is finding those that are willing to learn the message and are willing to bear children, lots of them, we'd have to give them some financial assistance because they just can't do it on their own. And the way it's going, it's going to get worse. According to this one meeting I went to the other day, or lecture, where the Fed Reserve man was there, and he said this upturn in the economy is just a false note, and it's going to get as bad or worse than 2009. So we're pretty much headed for another crash, and it's difficult to raise up healthy children when they're so broke they have to have two people get the job just to be able to have an apartment that lives in a nice neighborhood, not just a good neighborhood. So that's one thing that is difficult to do is once the movement gets further along, then we help these, and then that word gets out, and more come along, and more older people can help the youngers, because that's our future of our race, and if we don't do something about it, we have no race.
Gerald? I received a nice note on Chris DeGennie.
Yeah.
I mean, it's brief. I received a nice note in my mailbox tonight.
What is that?
It's kind of brief. It's from a guy that says, some of you people may know this guy. I don't know, may know this name. Mike McCray, McCray. He said, I am one of Gail's co-defendants in the committee of the states and know Roxanne and Kitty, and I was sure happy to find this site, meaning the Wesley Swift site. And I don't know if anybody knows this guy, but I just thought I'd mention it. And I didn't know, the Bill Gale people. I have no familiarity with them whatsoever.
No.
Oh, no, takers? No, I just thought I'd ask. Some of you old-timers, Clifton, Gerald, Tuniker, you're one of the old-timers.
I've heard of the Committee of the States and Gale. I don't remember anybody named McCray. The Committee of States is, I think it's more out in the West. They were trying to establish the original government, if I remember right. And they're claiming that there's a 14th Amendment government, and then there's this regular government that was established by the founding fathers. And there's some other things, and it was more like a patriotic protest type of organization.
Well, he contacted me today through the Swift site.
Hmm. He said he was a co-defendant.
Isn't that an ongoing thing right now? Aren't they active? Presently, I know there's there are tremendous movements going on, and actually some of the programs are on Talk Show, where you have the de jure government groups throughout the country that are separate from the Tea Party groups, but they're organizing and they're trying to set up. It's not a secession movement per se, but it is if they're successful in what they're trying to do, they would dissolve the federal government as we know it and institute the government going back to what was originally set up when this country was founded. Now, you say, that's not a viable situation, but it is gaining momentum throughout the country. And if you see some of these programs on Talk Show, you will see maybe up to 200 participants on any given night. And so it has a tremendous calling. And I don't know that, you know, we all talk about how there's no political solution, and I understand that. But these people are trying. That they're not CI people, although there are some CI people mixed within them. And, of course, you know, all roads lead to CI. And I can say that because I have witnessed it since the late 1950s. You generally start out, in the conspiracy or in the race. A lot of people in the South started their education through to segregation, promoting the segregation. And then they began to branch out, and before long, here come Mr. Kike. And they begin to find out that the Jews were behind a lot of things, and they started the revolution and a lot of other things, studied history, and they discovered they began to tie the pieces together. And I woke up one day and discovered that I had virtually proven the Bible by studying history. And, you know, as I got into studying CI, then, you know, I knew I was right. And I think CI is the culmination of all that we see and learn. I don't know that there could possibly be anything beyond CI except the kingdom and Yahshua's coming. So, all roads, I think, lead to CI. And so these people that's getting into these movements, you know, they're running up on this person and that person, and somebody says, hey, have you read this book, or have you read the Abraham Covenant booklet? Or they'll pass some other things, and then they get into the Israel identity. And, of course, W. Armstrong was instrumental in getting people started on that track. He was screwed up in many ways, but he did bring a lot of people into the Israel identity movement, just like British Israel did. Because we all know that British Israel has some major flaws, but it has awakened a lot of people. And, you know, if they just won't stop, and if they'll continue their studies, they're going to travel the yellow brick road to where I think a lot of us are today. And, of course, when you get into Swift and Comparay and then in the more modern people like Clifton and Bill and Eli and even Pastor Dan to some extent, and you know, there you are. And once you learn this message, you're trapped. I don't think you can ever. I don't see how anyone could ever turn their back on the Christian identity message. They truly learn it and have a working knowledge of it. I think to do that, you'd have to deny Yahshua and Yahweh and everything else. Correct me if I'm wrong there. Clifton, what do you think?
I think you're right. Yeah. Yeah. Put your hand to the plow. You don't dare look back, or you have an awful crooked your field will look terrible.
You know, I was so interested, Clifton, that first program that you came on. I think it was with Eli James. And I think it was the first program that you really came in on with him, and you were discussing how you began your studies, and you mentioned, of course, the Red Fog book by William Guy Carr.
William Guy Carr,
and
yeah.
I was very familiar with all those, and I thought how interesting, because that was the same avenue. Actually, it was Pawns in the Game that was one of my majors, but well, that and Iron Curtain Over America. I guess Iron Curtain Over America by Colonel Beatty, John Beatty, was the primer during the late and early 60s on the Jewish conspiracy. Now, it did not go into identity, but it really nailed the Jew and his participation in all what was wrong. And that was the book that these wonderful Republicans and John Birch Society people, that they were scared to say the word Jew. But if they had a good friend, that they would slip them this book. you know, and they'd tell them, don't you dare tell anybody where you got this book. But they would pass these books out. And Iron Curtain Over America was, I guess, one of the premier books on the conspiracy. And William Guy Carr was pretty much right in there with his two books, the Red Fog Over America and Pawns in the Game. And so interested in hearing you tell about how you got started and how one step led to another. But that's the point I was making. So many people start, once they start out on that road, if they continue, they're going to ultimately end up in the CIA camp, unless they get sidetracked by the white nationalist movements go off on those tangents. There's nothing wrong with white nationalist movements. I was friends with lots of people and lots of groups when I was up. I'm not going to name some of them, but I supported them, and to some extent I support them now if they're on the right track. But anyway, I didn't mean to get started, y'all. Excuse me.
Well, you know,
you have to just kind of hush me up.
You have to have a source of underground books. You know, these sources for underground books are drying up now. I don't know where you'd get some of these books today, like William Guy Carr and Iron Curtain Over America and various books.
I'll tell you where you're not going to get them. You're not going to get them on eBay. And the only place you can find some of them, there are some small little publishers out there that are publishing some of them. And Artesian, the publishers, they publish, of course, they publish a lot of CI books, but they publish some you're talking about. But you are correct. I noticed that most of the books in my library are almost unobtainable now. Even the guy that was in South Louisiana that did so much of the publishing of those books, his whole operation was wiped out in Katrina.
He had
put on microfilm. Yeah, Dr. James Warner.
Yeah, right.
I went down there several times. Of course, now he's CI. He was teaching Israel Identity Message many years ago in his newspaper that he put out. So, he was on the right track. But he printed so many of those original classic books, and operation is virtually gone now. I think he's still operating somewhere, but nothing on the scale. He lost all of his microfiche records and everything in Katrina. And it was just real. But I did get a lot of my library because as he would put books on microfiche, he didn't want to keep the original copies anymore. So consequently, I got a lot of my original copies from him. And I'm thankful now to have them. But anyway, that's all I had.
I remember when that Katrina was heading his way. And I don't know how I got a hold of him. Things work out after 25 years of this. And I had sent him a letter, I think it was, saying that if Katrina's head your way, get your stuff and get out. But I don't know, it was easier said than done. But I guess he didn't get out.
No, his entire area was tremendously flooded, big time. And he just literally lost everything. And it was real sad. He was a pretty nice fellow. None of us are perfect by any means. Well, except Bill, of course. But aside from Bill, we're none of us are really perfect.
I don't claim to be perfect.
I said that as a joke, Bill. I wasn't poking.
Only when he's on team speak. After that, he's like us.
Anyway, you cannot find these books much anymore, and it's real sad because so many of them are classics. And if y'all want a classic, see if you can find Iron Curtain Over America by John Beatty. And you know, so many of these books, it's funny, So many of these books that was written back in the 30s and 40s and 50s were written by high-ranking military people who had retired. These were not nobodies that was out there just right-wing extremists. These were important people, and a lot of them were part of the military establishment. But a lot of them were forced into retirement and are retired because of just the sheer age. But and that's true not only here in the United States, but it was true in Russia, and even into the Baltic states and Hungary and so many countries in that area. The military people were the ones that put out the books. And there are lots and lots and lots of books out there on the conspiracy written by these people. And, of course, they've been banned. They've been destroyed. You almost have to know what you're looking for to find them. But I'm blessed to have copies of many, many of these books that have been translated into English and printed by Britons. Britons was one of the major publishing houses in England that printed so many of the books that was on the conspiracy. And, of course, they printed some of the identity books there toward the end. But anyway, if you want to know anything about books, old books, contact me. I don't know it all, but I do have a working knowledge of the history of the conspiracy as written by a lot of these people. Of course, Nesta Webster, you know, I have all of her books. And, of course, one of the famous books that she put out was, well, it was put out under the name of the Morning Post out of London, but it was The Cause of World Unrest, and it was written in 1920. And it's a very, very hard book to come by. I have an original copy, but she exposed the protocols had just really had been printed in 1920 was when the English copy and the American copy was printed. And of course there was comments in Spain and even in Mexico, believe it or not. I have a copy of the protocols 1920 that was printed in Mexico. I have a Spanish edition, a French edition, and now I have a Russian edition. Well, it's not Russia per se. It's one of those countries over there. But I'm just dying to get it translated, and I think I may have even talked to Rick about that. But anyway, she wrote The Cause of World Unrest in 1920, and it's amazing that all of these books were put out. And now we've lost all that information except for our group. You know, we are a unique group because CI people are probably the most educated people, not only in Christian identity, but also in the conspiracy and history. You know, if y'all just listen to some of Bill Fink's programs, like on Sunday nights and all, you'll get a wealth of historical information. But we were blessed with newspapers, magazines, books that exposed the Jew and what was going on. And now nearly all of that's gone. And we don't have a lot out there. Now, the Internet has, I guess, taken the place of it. There are many, many, many good websites out there.
That's, Internet sites are kind of taking the place of the publishers almost, the hardback publishers.
Oh, right. Most of those books are available at Christogenia or the Saxon Messenger site or Clifton site. And the ones that aren't, I have on my hard drive and will be soon. But Iron Curtain Over America and William Guy Carr's book are both available on my on Christogenia.
Is it the whole book or just a chapter?
No, the entire book, the entire text of Iron Curtain Over America is on the Saxon Messenger site. The entire, a PDF copy of the entire William Guy Carr Pawns in the Game is available on Clifton's site.
You know, it's strange, but it seems like the Japanese have these conspiracy books. I think if we just search for them, find them online, a good share of them. They're already in PDF files.
You mean the English? Okay. Well, you know, believe it or not, Russia, somebody in Russia is printing a lot of the early conspiracy. Of course, a lot of them are Russian books, but they're putting them out in English, and they're printing them, and they're, believe it or not, they're selling them on eBay. And I was just real surprised to see these. Evidently, it must be a Jewish organization selling, because only Jews seem to be allowed to sell anything that's termed anti-Semitic. Right now, there's I think they're out of Israel, but they're selling original German documents, National Socialist books and booklets and newspapers, original copies of the 20s and 30s. And, of course, they only want anywhere from $100, $400 a piece for them. But they're selling them like crazy. And they would not let you or I sell anything that was anti-Semitic on eBay unless we snuck it in and it wasn't reported. The Jews are constantly looking at eBay, and anything that somebody puts out that's anti-Semitic and they catch it, they complain and have it removed before it can be sold. But if you're a Jew, you can sell just about anything on eBay. And I wish somebody would explain that to me. I just can't understand how that can happen. Perhaps eBay is owned by Jews.
Someone would have to be able to know German enough to compare it to see if it's a good translation or if it's all the words are really there.
Yeah, well, see, even Dr. Warner in New Orleans, you know, he was a great guy, and he published lots and lots and lots of books, but he would leave out a certain part of books, and it's just like the significance of the Russian Revolution that was written in, I think, 1919, which he reprinted it, and he left out Levy's I think it was Oscar Levy's letter at the preface of the book explaining, even though he was not anti-Semitic, that he was Jewish, but that Robert Tilton had written the correct information in that book, that it was 100% correct. And he left all that out, and I couldn't understand why he would leave out such an important part of that book. But I noticed that he left out lots of things when he reprinted books. So anytime you buy a book that's a reprint of a older classical work, be sure you're getting an unabridged copy. And, of course, that's kind of hard to do if you don't have an original to go by. But a lot of people are printing reprint things, and they're not printing the entire book.
Well, thanks to you, Gerald, the world significance of the Russian Revolution is standing on a Mein Kampf site.
Does it have the Levy letter in the preface?
If it didn't, I wouldn't have told you it was there.
Did I send that to you, or did you get it from someone else? Because I don't remember if we scanned it for you.
You got the credit for this on the Mein Kampf site when I put it up last year, so you must have sent it to me.
Okay.
It's only the JPEG facsimiles, but that's as good. That's better than a reprint with half the stuff missing, right?
Exactly.
But when I can get it into text, I'll get it into text. It might be 10 years. I got about 13 gigabytes of stuff waiting to go up on between the Mein Kampf site and the Saxon Messenger site. I don't know if I'm ever going to get it all up there.
Well, I wish I could get somebody that's in our group. I know there's a lot of people listening tonight, but I wish some of you fellas could have a week or something if you were computer literate, that you could come and help me get some scanning done so that I can scan a lot of these works. And there's a lot of things I promised Bill that I have to get scanned, but it's difficult for me to do it by myself. I'm in this motorized chair. And every time I start to try to get in here to scan, well, my legs hurt and I have to quit. But if I had someone to come help me, and of course they could stay here free, as long as they wanted to, and help me get some of this scanning done. It would be a tremendous asset for a lot of people, mainly Bill, but other people could use them too. So if any of y'all are interested and you'd like to come do something worthwhile, take me up on my offer and come here and help me get some of these books and papers scanned. Because if something happens, Yahweh forbid that my place was destroyed through a tornado or fire or something, everything I got would be destroyed because there's no backup off site. And of course, none of this stuff is scanned, and I would lose everything, and it would be a loss for us, I think. And if any of you might be interested, get in touch with me. And if some reason you don't have my email address or my phone number, Bill has it. A lot of people that have it, and you can always get in touch with me. But I would love to have some help and get some of this scanning work done. Don't everybody jump at once.
You got a big house. We'll all come down.
Well, it's not a big house, but I have a guest bedroom and a private bath. And of course, you'd have to share the house with Jocko. You know, that would be the only drawback. He rules roost. But
you can't bring a walk into the house. Jocko get real nervous.
Oh, yeah. Oh, boy. No walks. You have to leave the walk outside. But, it's a doable deal. And Bruce was going to come stay with me for a little bit, but things didn't work out, and he hadn't been able to make it down. I'm still holding out. Maybe he will someday.
I was thinking about picking you up in that.
I'm going to have to go.
Summer, yeah, traveling across country.
Okay. I'm going to have to turn it in, people. I've really enjoyed it, and I hope I haven't talked too much. Sometimes when I get started, I don't know when to quit. Nobody tells me to shut up, so I just keep going. But thank you all for listening, and I thank you, Bill, for hosting the program. And I wish all of y'all good night. Yahweh bless, and I'll tomorrow night, if there's a program on Chris Laos, I'll be tuning in to it. And good night to everyone.
Good night.
God bless, Gerald. Good night.
God bless. We enjoy your encouragement, Gerald. Good night. Yahweh bless. Well, I'm going to call tonight, too. Good night, folks. Yahweh bless.
Good night, Bruce.
I got to drive another 600 miles tomorrow. Good night.
Good night. Bring a whistle next time with bells.
Okay, so what else is going on? We have that much, huh?
They're percolating.
Anybody wants to talk, this is your big chance. Yes, no, maybe. I don't have anything more to say. I ran my mouth too much this weekend already. Oh, I'll just end the program and we could all go down to the open house. It's been it's been almost 2.5 hours anyway. Okay, this is the Chris Degany Open Forum program, and thank you, everybody, and good night.
Good night.